Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community change practical and doable. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. My guest today on Making Change is John McKnight. To many in the community benefit sector, John is a bit of a legend, the founder of the Asset-Based Community Development Institute, and the author of many books on creating grassroots community change, including his latest book, written with Peter Block, The Abundant Community. For decades, John has been a leader in the movement to build upon the strengths of average citizens to create the communities they want to live in. And so it is my pleasure to have John share his observations with us today here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is John McKnight. To some, John needs no introduction, but I would love to have you introduce yourself, John. Tell the group a little bit about yourself. I am so pleased and excited to have you with us. I have to confess that I have been a fan of yours for a very, very, very long time. So it's very exciting for me to be able to actually chat with you. And I'd love you to tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are that would make me such a fan.
Well, it's good to be here. I started my career as a neighborhood organizer in Chicago. And then I was the director for a while of the Illinois American Civil Liberties Union.
Well, I'm going to go back. Can you tell me, when were you an organizer in Chicago?
Started in 1956, so it's a few years ago.
Yep.
It was in the heyday of Saul Alinsky
that
I was doing organizing. Then after the American Civil Liberties Union, Kennedy was elected, and I went into the government with the Kennedy administration.
Wow.
And the more notable thing that I was involved in there was creating the Affirmative Action Program.
Wow.
The now sometimes infamous Affirmative Action Program. But I was one of the group of people who were brought in to create that program and to establish it. And then I got an offer to come to Northwestern University, which I had graduated, and to start up what was called a program in community studies at a new center for urban affairs. So the rest of my working career there for about 35 years. I still have a research appointment there, but I'm now much freer than I used to be. So that's the brief history.
It is fascinating. I know that I could probably chat with you for 17 interviews on just each of the things that you said, but we will move to the question that I start all of these interviews with, which is, you have been doing this work, you and I were calculating before, for about 60 plus years.
Right.
And over the course of those years, you've seen social change efforts that work. You've seen social change efforts that don't work. When you see groups being effective in creating change, what is undergirding that change? What is happening in those efforts that's not happening in the efforts that don't work?
Now, I have to say that I have focused on one part of the society, and that's neighborhoods, local communities. So that's where I would make my observations.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that significant change almost always happens when people there act like citizens rather than consumers or clients. There is, at the local level, a great temptation, I think, for local people to come to believe that not-for-profit organizations, government organizations, corporations, are the givers of life, that and all of them offer us an opportunity to buy a future. So if a community is a consumer community, I think it isn't going to change much, because the essential element for change is a citizen. And if people have converted themselves from being citizens, and by that I mean citizen is somebody who has a vision for the future and will join with other people, in this case neighbors, to make that vision come true. The opposite of that is Somebody has to give us a grant. Somebody has to come in and fix us. Somebody has to give us money so that we can buy a life. And those neighborhoods don't change. So I think the bedrock is, are the people there convinced that together they have the power to make a difference? And that the critical difference is that relationship, that organization, that coming together. Now, I would also add that large-scale developments happen in societies, and people who weren't acting like citizens become part of a cultural shift that leads them to act like citizens.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, that's what a movement is, right? And okay. We can think about the civil rights movement, or the women's movement, or the environmental movement. All of those movements emerged when people began to have a consciousness that said, together we can make the difference because we're citizens. This is a democracy, and a democracy is for letting citizens have their ideas and their vision and making it come true. So events emerge that bring people to the consciousness of their power as citizens, who might have been not expressing that before that. I mean, you think about the environmental movement, a lot of consciousness was raised by public events. And then one day, Gaylord Nelson said, let's have a National Earth Day. And it just burst out because all kinds of people began to be convinced that what was wrong was not just the things that they couldn't control, huge oil spills in Alaska, for instance, but that they themselves, with their neighbors, friends, relatives, the primary groups, could do things that would make a difference. And that's where the green movement came from, where recycling came from, right? People who assumed they had the power to be a part of the solution and that they weren't going to do it by buying the solution, because you can't.
Mm-hmm. When you're seeing this happen on a small scale, when you're seeing this happen in communities, in neighborhoods, where it is not a huge movement for change, it's not event-driven, it's not crisis-driven, you mentioned before that people need to become convinced that they have the power to make that difference. What convinces them? What have you seen work in having people realize that they have that power?
Well, I started out as a neighborhood organizer in the Alinsky era, and one answer to that we would have given back then is organizers, people who have the skill and knowledge of how to create a powerful organization with the assets and resources that are in the neighborhood. And that's what the neighborhood organizing movement, I think, was at the beginning, and still on the Alinsky side of things, still is. It is the assumption, Saul Alinsky used to say, it isn't that people aren't organized. They aren't organized for power. Mm-hmm. And what he meant by that is most people belong to smaller groups, associations, organizations, voluntary groups, and they are the infrastructure of belonging. But what doesn't usually happen at the local level is that they come together and create an organization that becomes the effective voice of the neighborhood. Before that time, I think, people thought in a neighborhood they were going to do something, the way they would proceed would be as individuals. And you have a neighborhood of 6,000 people and 17 neighbors get together, they can do some things, but it's limited. But if there are 60 associations in the neighborhood that people belong to, then if you get them together and get them to develop a common vision of what they want for the future, you really have the muscle to make some real difference. So organizers I think, have been a major factor in a sense, showing people how to connect the resources that are there. And almost all citizen action of consequence is about that, is about people recognizing the asset base they have and making new connections among themselves and the other neighborhood assets. So organizers, I think, are people who precipitate that kind of thing. On the other hand, we see all over the country people who get an idea, right, of what could be done at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not a paid organizer. They're a person who lives on the block. And
right.
They take the initiative to begin to bring their neighbors together and to create some kind of vision and action together. I've written a book recently with Peter Block. It's called The Abundant Community. And it's trying to reflect those kind of people and their actions at the very local level. And it's also trying to get people to start being the connectors in their local neighborhood, to create what we're calling a connectors table, a way of bringing together the gifts, skills, and the capacities of neighbors and beginning to make the connections that will allow change in the neighborhood at a fairly significant level. For instance, we've just been doing some interviews with people in neighborhoods. And if you ask in most neighborhoods people, do you believe that it takes a village to raise a child? Well, everybody's heard mm-hmm. that saying. And everybody agrees that it does take a village to raise a child. So then if you take the next step and you say, if the village is your block or two blocks or three blocks around you, that's your village, tell us what mm-hmm. you're doing to raise your children. Now, we're not asking what the school's doing, and we're not asking what your family is doing. We're asking what the village, the collected group of people in your area, that's what the village is. And
wow.
Not very many people can answer that question in any positive way. Most people will say, after they think about it, in fact, I don't think that we do anything to raise the children.
Mm.
And so here's a great opening, and I see some beginning movement of people who are beginning to try to bring neighbors together around taking new responsibility for both the education and the cultural and social definition of what we do here in our neighborhood. What is our way here in this neighborhood?
Can you share a story with us, John, about that, about what you've seen when neighbors do come together, create that village, and create some change?
Well, one way that I think effective and innovative is that one or two people on the block decide to go and ask everybody on the block, door by door, what they know well enough that they could teach it to somebody, either a child or an adult. And what these people have found on those blocks is, so you do that on two blocks, right? What they found is that what people know that they could teach is more than what the elementary school across the street is teaching or could teach.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening is they're uncovering the capacities of citizens to be problem solvers and creators. And that requires knowing what the skills, gifts, and capacities of local people are, and then
sure.
making the connection. So taking that information about what people can teach, making that knowledge available to everybody on the block, and making the connection between kids who are interested in what that person has to teach and the adults who are involved. Now, this is a wonderful way of organizing a block.
Now, are there neighborhoods that are doing that you're familiar with?
Yep. Right now, there are a couple in various parts of the United States who are engaged in that kind of an experiment. Some in Chicago, some in Cincinnati in particular that I'm aware of.
And what are they finding?
A lot more than they ever thought they'd find. And they're finding a lot more diversity than they thought they'd find. So they'll find somebody who says, what I know is motorcycle repair. And somebody else will say, well, I've always been pretty good at math. Somebody else will say, I know the saxophone. Somebody else will say, I know more about big league baseball than almost anybody in the world. I mean, there's a huge diversity of what people know.
Now, that big league baseball thing, that must be Chicago.
So once you begin to uncover the invisible citizen asset, everybody is surprised to see what's there. For your listeners, if they are in a foundation or on a board of a not-for-profit, start your next meeting by asking everybody there to write down their most significant gift of the head, things they know, gifts of the hand, things they can do, gifts of the heart, things they have a passion for. Let them tell everybody, just go around the circle and let everybody there know what the answer to those three things is, and you'll transform your board.
Yep.
Board members have been sitting there, in a sense, giftless, right? People who are rich with possibilities and talents, and we have no common way of eliciting that knowledge. So I think the movement that you see beginning to develop, and I think it develops an awful lot because there are now a fair number of people who feel, I'm alone. I need to be connected. Now, we see it a lot being manifested on the Internet, but the Internet imagines that I can click a computer button and have a friend, which is a wild idea if I ever heard one. But the same thing that makes people so interested in these electric social networks is also manifesting itself among people in the other part of their life, that is their life that is real.
Right.
Not unreal, right? And so the other thing we can see is that there are a lot of people who feel like they're isolated, alone, they're not part of a community, and they want to begin to make those kinds of connections. And those are the people we're connecting with. We want to connect to other people who are doing the same thing.
What does it make possible when they do connect? What have you seen come out of those connections?
There are six areas where you can see in various ways people at the local level who've identified their gifts, their skills, their capacities, and their associations in the local neighborhood. And those areas are, first, an area of safety. And that we all know. Often block clubs get started because of insecurity. And so there are a series of things that neighbors can do to be more secure once they become connected.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people can see that, right? But then there are five other areas where the same is true. The second area is health, that we know very clearly from epidemiologists that about 10 to 15% of the average person's health will be determined by access to medicine. 85 to 90% has to do with a series of things that have to do with your relationships with other people, mostly in the local neighborhood.
Wow.
So there are health initiatives beginning, and there have been some at the local level saying, we have a way of being helpful together. In fact, I was just in Arlington, Virginia, where a couple of women on a block decided to work with the school, and they raised a huge amount of money, $10 or something like that, to buy lettuce seeds, right, for every kid, and teach the kids how they could grow lettuce at home.
Gotcha.
They so all the kids take the lettuce home, right, the seeds, and get their parents to plant them, and their parents feel that they ought to. So they're introducing them to gardening, right?
Yep.
And then they had this spring, and they just had this fall, second round, the great salad party at the school. Right? These women from Vox. So, and also, I think Michelle Obama has urged this effort to deal with obesity. Right? And in her opening statement, she says the federal government can do very little about that. And so it really is going to move if we do something locally, which in a way means, are we organized to raise our children?
Mm-hmm.
Are we a village to raise our children?
Yeah.
Are we raising children in such a way that they're not sedentary food sumps watching electrical tubes, electric games, right? So health is another area. Another area is the environment. You see much more local action about environment. Let's reduce waste. Let's do something about how we light our house. Let's do something to keep from driving our cars more. So that's a local action manifestation of taking on the environmental issue. Then there's there are also issues that have to do with food. And I don't know whether you know this, but the local food movement is growing by leaps and bounds all over this country. And that brings together three kinds of local interests. People who are concerned about nutrition, people who are concerned about health, and people who are concerned about economy, and also people who are concerned about pollution.
Yep.
All of those things coming together around food. And another area is the local economy. People coming together in connected neighborhoods share information about jobs and are in some places beginning to be at a couple block levels supporting local enterprise, home-based businesses, and that kind of thing. And finally, there's the question of children. I see the most hopeful activities there, people beginning to say, we really have lost our children. Peter Block, my co-author, says, we have outsourced America's children. Right?
Ooh, wow.
We have this illusion that we can pay people from teachers to probation officers to music teachers to sports directors to McDonald's to raise our children.
Mm.
And we're paying a huge price.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I don't think we have a school problem. I think we have a village problem.
I love the image of the village being a real village. I mean, we talk about it so metaphorically, but it really, when we get down to it being a real village, what are we really doing within that village? There's real power in that.
And, you know, one of the things, try this if you haven't seen it yourself. When we get together with a group of people who are over 35 or 40, we ask them to tell us they're raised in a city or in a small town. Tell us what it was like when you were raised. If they're over 40, there's one universal story at least, and it is, when I was a kid, if I did anything wrong down the street, my mother would know about it in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard that story?
I could tell you that story.
Now, you say to the same people, right, they're 40, 50, 60, tell me how it is on your block now.
Right.
And they say, well, I'm afraid to talk to the kid.
Mm.
Now, what that tells you is that in one short generation, in many American neighborhoods, we have dissolved our village. We had this a generation
ago.
And what's happened is that we have become disconnected consumers, bought in to a life surrounded by television, computers, electric toys, shopping marts, and that environment dissolves communities.
Well, it sounds like you are actually in the process right now of using one of those tools to bring together the wisdom of folks that are actually working in communities. Can you talk just briefly before we go, because I wish we weren't running out of time, but I would love you to share just a little bit about the website that you and Peter Block have created at abundantcommunity.com.
Right. It's a website in which we are trying to get people, started with people who read our book, The Abundant Community, but it's spreading every year. Every month there are more and more people go to the website. And the website is an invitation to let us know if you are an inventor or a creator of a new kind of responsibility and initiative in your block or the nearby block. And then we want to do two things. We will engage with you personally. But secondly, we will put you in personal touch with other people who are doing the same kinds of things. And thirdly, we'll bring you together in gatherings in maybe your state with people who are doing this kind of exploring, creating, adventuring at the local level.
This is really exciting stuff. This is really taking all of the work that you have been doing for so many years and ratcheting it up to the next level. It's so exciting, and I am thrilled that you could be with us today, John. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's a wonderful opportunity to be with you.
Terrific. And hopefully, as things move along with you, you will come back and share some more of your observations with us.
Be glad.
Thanks, John. John's experience in neighborhood organizing has been an object lesson for so many community leaders over the years. Perhaps the most notable example of engaging individuals in their own strengths has occurred in the disability rights community, where the question of who should make decisions about folks with disabilities has led to the rallying cry of "Nothing about us without us." If decisions are going to be made about us, we had better be part of that process. As we consider the gains made by advocates for people with disabilities, we see what is possible when individuals are made conscious of their own power. Yes, people fighting for disability rights still have a long way to go, but it is fairly common knowledge that the gains they've made to date are in large part because ordinary citizens claimed their power over the decisions that were affecting their lives. Which leads to the question of the work we're doing in our own communities. What are community benefit organizations doing to ignite the power of the people in our communities to create their own change, to engage people in building their own villages? There are so many strong groups in the communities where our organizations work, the scout groups and soccer teams, the church groups, the neighborhood watch teams, the book clubs. What are our organizations doing to connect those existing groups to each other so they can strengthen the real on-the-ground villages they live in every day? What are we doing to help our communities first see their own dots, as John put it, uncovering the invisible citizen assets, and then helping them connect those dots? Are we functioning as connectors of existing neighborhood strengths, or are we acting simply as neighborhood service providers, perpetuating the belief that help comes from outside the neighborhood, not from within it? I hope you will explore these questions with us as we continue this conversation at the Chronicle of Philanthropy's group at LinkedIn. And please remember that you can always find great ways to connect, as well as other terrific information, at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or follow the Chronicle on Twitter at @philanthropy. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me on Twitter, I'm @HildeGottlieb, or at our website, creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening, and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.